From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, 12 dead in a D.C. shooting, a shutdown threat on Obamacare, an opening with Iran, and more. On Monday, ex-Navy man Aaron Alexis killed 12 people at the D.C. Navy Yard before being shot down by police. At 8:21 that morning, first reports of a gunman on a shooting rampage crackled across fire dispatch radio.
We had a report on the fourth floor, a male with a shotgun. Multiple shots fired, multiple people down.
House Republican leadership threw in with Tea Party Obamacare opponents for a hard line on the health care reform that now threatens a government shutdown. Here's House Speaker John Boehner yesterday.
The law's a train wreck, and it's going to raise costs, it's destroying American jobs, and it must go.
In an interview with NBC, the new Iranian president Hassan Rouhani said that he has exchanged letters with President Obama and that his country would not develop nuclear weapons.
President Obama wrote a letter to me. In that letter, he congratulated my election, and some issues of his interest were raised in that letter.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with John McCormick of the Weekly Standard, Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Where are you on the latest mass shooting, on Obamacare and the shutdown threat? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us today from Washington, John McCormick, staff writer for the Weekly Standard. John, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
With us from New York is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation, author of The Change I Believe In, Fighting for Progress in the Age of Obama. Katrina, welcome to you.
Thank you, Tom.
And from Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack. Hello, Jack. Are you there? We'll work on that line. We'll work on that line. Let's listen to some of the sound from Washington right here. John, Katrina, here's Republican Congressman from Texas. This is Blake Farenthold telling CNN's Wolf Blitzer he supports defunding Obamacare because it's, he says, what the American people want.
I think the American people want Obamacare defunded. That's what I heard at all my town hall meetings. The surveys are showing it. Heck, the president is even giving exemptions to his corporate friends. His friends, the labor unions, all saying, bad idea.
And here's the president calling the whole thing extortion.
You have never seen in the history of the United States the debt ceiling or the threat of not raising the debt ceiling being used to extort a president or a governing party, and trying to force issues that have nothing to do with the budget and have nothing to do with the debt.
Okay, we have very different views in our guest today. Katrina, you write GOP madness on display. John McCormick, you write never surrender. John, describe for us what happened in the dance between House leadership and hard opponents of Obamacare in the House this week.
Well, Republicans genuinely oppose Obamacare. They think it's a bad law, that it's going to do more harm than good. But what we're seeing right now in Congress is basically posturing. We have some Republicans who just want to show their constituents that they did everything absolutely possible to stop Obamacare before the subsidies started flowing on January 1st. I don't think we're actually going to get to anything close to a shutdown over the government on this thing. I think Republicans know that at the end of the day, that the president is not going to stop his signature issue, just as President Bush wouldn't end the Iraq War when there were Democrats in the House and the Senate who controlled those bodies. So I think that's where we're heading.
Katrina, is it clear that there won't be a shutdown? I'm looking at the LA Times here. David Lauder, Lisa Mascaro writing, government shutdown is no idle threat. Seems increasingly likely, they write, and to some inevitable. In less than 2 weeks, the federal government may shut its doors, Katrina.
I think it's fully possible in light of, you know, GOP madness, or as Paul Krugman writes in the New York Times today, in light of what we've seen from the crazy party, we're witnessing the possibility of a shutdown. And you know, Tom, it's not a political game. I mean, it is sort of played as the shutdown showdown. But I think we're looking at a fundamental showdown over the role of government in stemming rising inequality, making our country a fairer and more decent place. And I think you're looking at a Republican Party throwing the political equivalent of a temper tantrum, but also deeply concerned that Obamacare will succeed and that in that success, there's a fear on the Republicans' part that people will once again see that government can work at a time when the safety net is being shredded by Republicans. And the Republican right gearing up to hold America hostage, Tom, no longer even claiming that it's about a debt crisis, which we don't have, but about the signature policy of this president. It truly is extortionism. And, you know, you have us on, John and I on, because we're supposed to represent two different polls of opinion. But listen to Norm Ornstein, someone who's been on your program before, the congressional scholar, someone who has studied Congress for years. He has said that what we're witnessing with Congress on this front, Obamacare, debt ceiling, budget showdown, is unprecedented in U.S. history. Quote, the level of sabotage of government that leaders of the GOP are pushing for is unprecedented. So I think we need to look very hard at our political system and understand that the Republicans lost an election, lost out in the fight over Obamacare, but they're going to – small part of them now being kowtowed to by a leadership which is wuss-like is possibly going to lead to a showdown. Never say never.
John, let me ask you about that. I mean, here's the Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, and yes, as you say, many Republicans seriously opposed to it. We can hear that all over the place. On the other hand, it passed Congress. It passed through the Supreme Court. Is the president calls what's going on here extortion? Is that fair, John? What about Norm Ornstein's never happened before characterization?
Well, it's just simply not true. The Washington Post gave him four Pinocchios, their fact checker, gave that to the president for saying that there have never been things attached to debt limit deals like what Republicans are asking for now. I just don't think that that's you can substantiate that claim that this has never been done before. I mean, the American people oppose this law. If you look at the polls, majorities oppose it. Do I think that they want a government shutdown over this? No, obviously not. You don't want to resort to extreme legislative maneuvers.
But that is the threat, right? I mean, that's what's on the table here.
From a very small minority, there have been reports that up to 180 Republicans in the House of Representatives will ultimately vote for a clean CR, meaning just to keep the same levels of funding going.
Continuing resolution.
Top Obamacare. The budget deal. The big question to me is, are there going to be 40? I mean, these budget deals have ended the exact same way every single time. The two sides disagree. You said President Obama won an election. Well, that's true. The House also, Republicans won an election.
No, I didn't say that. I simply said it passed Congress and it passed through the Supreme. It got the Supreme Court sign off. That's what I said.
Exactly. So we have divided government and we have negotiations of two different opposing views, and they're going to negotiate this. And there are going to be 180 Republicans at the end of the day who will vote for a clean budget deal, a CR, continuing resolution.
By which you mean a continuing resolution without funding for the Affordable Care Act?
No, that will. The Affordable Care Act is funded. The Affordable Care Act is funded through mandatory entitlement spending.
Yeah.
If they don't pass a continuing resolution, that doesn't stop funding for Obamacare. The subsidies will still flow on January 1st, just as Social Security and Medicare will. But a lot of things won't, and a lot of people would get hurt if we had a government shutdown. So the question to me is whether or not Democrats, whether the president will give anything. President Obama has compromised a little bit in all the previous negotiations. On the last debt limit deal, Republicans had a very big ask for something called cut-cap balance that would have cut lots and lots of money. They ended up with sequestration.
Mm-hmm.
The president wanted to let income tax rates rise on people over $250,000 during the fiscal cliff. Instead, there was a bit of a compromise, and it was about $400,000 was the level. So the question to me is whether or not President Obama will negotiate at all. And he's saying right now he won't give anything. And I think that could lead to a scary situation with the debt.
But John,
give anything on Obamacare, you're saying. But it already passed in the Supreme Court, signed off on it.
It passed in the Supreme Court. I mean, it's also, Tom, what we're looking at is something quite cruel, which is now you have with the Wall Street Journal, and you know when the Wall Street Journal is taking on the extremists, things are askew or the parties at war. It's interesting. I mean, we have diplomacy alive again in the world, but it kind of war at home between the Republicans, which is political theater, but if there was not so much at stake. But, you know, we're looking at a party which it wants to undercut and destroy the implementation of a healthcare program which could give millions better, cheaper coverage, which could keep people from being uninsured and the pain of that.
But they're against it, Katrina, and they say this is the lever we've got.
But that, here there's another level of madness here, which is that the Republicans have gotten the best of each of the budget crises they have manufactured. They've succeeded in slashing government spending at a time when the economy needs a boost. They preserved most of the Bush tax cuts, still skewed to the richest. And they've protected the subsidies and tax dodges of the rich and corporations. Now, President Obama has gotten a spine. his moxie, and he's not going to negotiate on raising the debt ceiling. And he's not going to sign on to the delay of defunding his signature program. I mean, we're looking at harsh and mindless across-the-board cuts at a time when the poverty rate in this country is there's the greatest gap between rich and poor we've seen. Inequality is metastasizing. There must be a sense of a patriotic purpose of investing in a country to rebuild its security and health and infrastructure, which seems to have been lost. You know, there's this view that you're anti-business if you raise these issues of tax cuts for the richest. No, there used to be an enlightened kind of Eisenhower Republican Party which understood you don't slash a safety net, especially at a time of great inequality,
Katrina,
when our recovery is still struggling.
Yeah, I want to get Jack, we didn't have you at first. Here we got just a few seconds before the break. But do you see a real threat here? Is this pure theater, Jack, or a real threat of a shutdown? What do you see?
Oh, I think it is a real threat. The situation is out of the leadership's control, and the crucial actor here is Speaker Boehner. As John said, he could pass a clean CR. If he does that, though, it'll be with Democratic votes, and that is likely to be unacceptable to his caucus and to cost him his seat, his job.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, the Navy Yard massacre, Obamacare and shutdown threats, new signals from Iran, the Pope, and there's Syria. John McCormick is with us, staff writer for the Weekly Standard. Katrina Vandenhoevel is here, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine, and Jack Beatty's here. And we've heard the sound of this fight this week. Here was Republican Senator from Utah, Mike Lee, one of the earliest promoters of defunding Obamacare through a vote on the continuing resolution on the budget, appearing on Fox News with Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz. Lee is saying the GOP did not want to shut down the government.
We agree that we would fund government and defund Obamacare. I have never wanted a shutdown, never called for a shutdown. I want to avoid a shutdown. What I'm saying is that we ought to fund every other priority in government. Ted and I and others are willing to fund even programs that we don't like as a compromise gesture in order to avoid having to fund Obamacare.
We just want to avoid that. That's all we want. On Thursday, Democrat Chuck Schumer, Senator, said the GOP is taking a my way or highway approach.
And their my way or the highway approach has carried the day. In this case, the highway leads over a cliff to a shutdown or a default, either of which would be devastating for the economy. Republican leadership has been dragged kicking and screaming into a fight that they know is bad for their party and bad for their country, and they should know it's a fight they will not win.
John McCormick, you hear Katrina Vandenhoevel's characterization of the big fight here. How do you describe the sort of big meta conflict that we are once again in the teeth of here?
I mean, there's obviously just a divide, a big contrast of visions between the president and the House Republicans. They both were elected, and now they have to try and sort this thing out. Rand Paul from Kentucky, who's one of the most conservative members of the Congress, has actually suggested this is all, you know, somewhat a negotiating tactic, that you start out with your original position and you hope to get to some compromise. He suggested maybe a delay of the law or even just a delay of the individual mandate so long as the corporations and businesses get their delay, which President Obama just handed out, that individuals, families, that they should have a delay for the exact same amount of time from being required. So I don't think that this is going to end up in such a dramatic clash that we're actually going to shut down unless Democrats sort of lead Republicans into that and refuse to pass even a deal that is keeps funding going
at
current levels.
But what about normal business? I mean, a lot of people, some people look at this and say whatever it takes to stop Obamacare. Others, like here's a listener on Facebook, Adam says, the GOP keeps trying to make the rest of us die on a hill it's already lost. I mean, we've got normal business. It went through Congress. It went through the Supreme Court. I mean, it's Republicans who are now taking this extraordinary measure. Is that healthy, John?
I mean, Democrats held votes on defunding the war in Iraq, and at the end of the day, there was never a government shutdown over it because President Obama was president, or President Bush was president. And as long as President Obama is president, Obamacare will be law of the land. But that doesn't mean that Congress, that Republicans have to give up their principles. No one was saying the Democrats should, oh, well, you know, President Bush won re-election in 2004. You should give up on opposing the Iraq war. No, no one said that. There was a debate. There was a clash of ideas. They had that debate.
But holding the budget of the entire nation and maybe soon the good full faith and credit of the nation at risk?
Well, that hasn't happened yet, and I don't expect there to be. At the end of the day, what is asked for on the debt limit will be a modest ask. It will be anti-fraud measures to make sure that people who are getting the Obamacare subsidies are actually qualify for that. It might be something like a delay of the individual mandate, which would only be fair, in my opinion. I don't think that you're they're starting out from their position of principle, and eventually in negotiations, you hopefully get to some compromise. And again, like I said, Speaker Boehner said President Obama is willing to negotiate with Vladimir Putin. He's not going to negotiate with me.
But when is the negotiation over, I guess, is the question. On the other hand, lots of people at this point, after all this conversation, uncertain about Obamacare. Let's go to our listeners, Albuquerque, New Mexico. John, you're on.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Okay.
Okay. I think, as I had to talk to one of your other staff members before, that the people just really don't want this. I think mainstream America really doesn't want Obamacare. And the problem is that when it gets forced down our throat like this, you know, this is what happens, is that it's going to come to a showdown. Both sides are going to play hardball, but I think in the end there will be compromise. However, I do firmly believe that it's something that should not be shoved down the throats of mainstream America.
John, you say shoved down our throats, but it went in total proper order through the Congress of the United States. It went through the Supreme Court of the United States. In what sense is that shoved down the throat of, John?
Because I think that, you know, in the end, we're listening to what people are telling us today, and they just don't want to. They just don't want it. I mean, that may have been the case before, but this is today now.
Well, I mean, some don't want it, and some considerable number. I take that, Jack. I hear you.
Yeah, you know, John talks about a compromise as the president delaying the individual mandate. The individual mandate's the heart of the law. That's to gut the law. The business mandate is secondary.
Away the individual mandate, you gut
the whole
law.
Thing goes.
Of
yeah.
course, but that was Mitt Romney's. That was the heart of Mitt Romney's
of
reform.
Of course, it was that socialist. I mean,
well, no, it's not. Mitt Romney surely didn't think of himself as socialist when he pushed that through in Massachusetts.
He certainly didn't, and it wasn't thought to be socialist when the Heritage Foundation proposed it 25 years ago. But times change. I mean, John, I think from New Mexico makes the point we don't want it. Well, you know, the 52%, I guess it figures around there that you know don't want the bill. First of all, if you break it down into its parts, do you want insurance companies, you know, to be pre-existing conditions, limits,
covered,
and
yep.
all the rest? People say, "Oh yeah, we want all that." And also, that 50-some-odd percent includes people who want single payer. That is, who wanted more.
That's right.
So it's a much more muted opposition than John is letting off. There was great opposition to Social Security. There was great opposition to President
Absolutely.
Bush's extension of funding for drugs, for prescription drugs. After the bugs were worked out, the idea of taking that away from people today is inconceivable. Everyone recognizes that Bush policy worked. And I think the Republicans are afraid, in fact, that experience will make this law seem far more palatable to Americans as they benefit.
Yeah, I mean, there's John in New Mexico. He's not so sure. I'll come right to you, Katrina. One more, if I may. Rockland, Maine. Amy, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, I'm calling. I am one of those people who wants this to go through. It will greatly affect me. I moved to Maine a year ago, and when I researched health insurance, it was just absolutely not in my budget, you know, around $700 a month, and I'm starting a graphic design business. So as of January, I will be able to afford health insurance, and I'm very excited to buy my own health insurance. I am responsible in the meantime. You know, I've done an interim kind of emergency health insurance that doesn't cover anything. But I guess my question is, I hear the Republicans saying that they want to protect us from this law. I agree, it's not perfect. There are many other things that need to be dealt with in the healthcare industry. But as of January, I will be able to afford health insurance. If what they do as planned, I will not have any health insurance. I won't have adequate health insurance. So what's their solution? I just see them opposing this. I don't hear any solution.
Amy, I appreciate your call. Katrina VandenHeuvel, they've got opposition out of New Mexico. You've got a caller from Maine who can't wait to have it. Of course, you know, in major policy changes come around, there's always a divided views on them. But here we are, maybe bringing everything to a screeching halt. How do we ever solve this?
But first of all, it's very good to hear the voice of a human being, a person.
Sure.
So much of this has played out inside the Beltway with, you know, congressional squabbling.
But it was two human beings.
But Amy does speak as a young person.
Yeah.
She's a young person. Part of what the Obamacare program will do is bring health insurance to young people who can stay on their parents' plan or who would otherwise not have it. Being a woman is no longer a pre-existing condition. Has the administration been able to explain the program effectively to millions of Americans? No. But underlying that is what I began with, is that there is a fundamental issue here, and it's not just a political game. This is a fundamental showdown over the role of government in stemming rising inequality, making our country fairer, more decent place, foiling Obamacare. It would mean denying health insurance to millions of Americans who won't get it otherwise. And I think there's a cruelty in that. I think Jack makes a very important point, which is often lost in our great U.S. of amnesia, which is the way great social programs have come forward. They begin imperfectly, but they become part of the fabric of people's lives, Social Security, Medicare. And then voters, people, believe it's a part of their lives, which again is why I think the Republicans have decided to fight this crazy fight, which even people like Karl Rove, for example, as you understand, think is insane that the extremists in the House are fighting
but
this
fight. But
what do
you say to those people who don't want this to be part of American
program,
life?
But the central worry is not that the program will fail, but that it will succeed. And this is why many years ago, Bill Kristol, editor of the Weekly Standard, fought so ferociously hard to make sure that Clinton's health care plan would go down in flames, because there was an understanding that once that kind of program is woven into people's lives, it's something they expect. Now, will they credit the party which has supported it, which has passed it, which has fought for it? You know, I don't know. And I am one of those people, Tom, who believes that we need Medicare for all. We need to expand. But the history of social programs is that they expand. Social Security, when it was passed,
but that's what this is all about in some ways, that those Republicans who don't want that expansion. John McCormick, I'll bring that to you. Let me get a
call.
They
don't want anything.
Well, yes, they do. They've got a different...
I mean, they don't want any part of Obamacare. The idea of an anti-fraud program, give me a break. They should be seized with anything.
They've got a different set of interests. I'll grant you that. But it's something. Savannah, Georgia. Neil, you're on the air.
Yes, I guess I just wanted to make the comment that I think in a lot of ways conservatives are underestimating the way in which our safety net programs, particularly like the SNAP benefit that's been gutted and, you know, the obstruction of affordable health care, the way in which those things sort of subsidize like the low wages that we've seen for a long time.
Yes.
And I don't know if it's a good or a bad thing, but if you're a large corporation, in a way, the government programs are good for you because you can pay people lower wages and they can still
meet their basic needs. So your message to Republicans is what, Neil?
I guess my message would be, like, don't fight so hard against government subsidies. You know, in a way, they benefit you, I believe. You know, Walmart might have to pay less taxes if, you know, they cut food stamps. But at the same time, they're like one of the, you know, largest recipients of, you know, that food stamp.
Their employees are living on those stamps. John McCormick, how about it? You can't have it both ways. If you get a lot of inequality, we're going to have more support for Americans. And we've got a lot of inequality now. You hear our caller, John.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, this law will succeed or fail ultimately based upon its performance. Reality is what's going to determine whether this law is a good thing or a bad thing.
Well, not necessarily, because the Republicans don't want it to go into effect. So
they don't, but we know it's going to happen. It's mandatory spending. Even if Republicans have a government shutdown for temporarily, it's not going to stop Obamacare. And I think it's going to be bad. I think that 80% of young – we just had a caller who is a young person who's going to benefit. And I don't deny there will be some people who benefit, but there have been a recent study that said Obamacare, 80% of people under 30 who are now on the individual market will end up paying more for health insurance, even with subsidies. What Obamacare does is it mandates someone – it's not simply mandating that you have to buy health care. It mandates exactly what it must cover. It's not real insurance. It's prepaid health plans. And I think if we had a greater variety of plans, more competition, that could actually lower costs.
Hold there just one second. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. But speak to our caller from Savannah who says – dear Republicans, you know, here we are. We've had these decades where wages are stagnant or falling. And how can you be surprised then that people are going to want or need more active government to come in and support them? You know, our caller's kind of saying, hey, John, you can't have it all. You can't have it both ways.
Well, they need jobs. I think that they need it. They need a pro-growth agenda.
Well, they got jobs at Walmart that don't pay enough for them to eat. And a lot of them are on food stamps. which we're cutting. Speak to the philosophical problem, there is
Medicaid, and I don't think that, and I think that there should be assistance for people who are struggling to purchase it. There are different ways to do that. There are different ways to structure these tax credits to help people who really need the help. And rather than raising costs for everyone by mandating exactly what health insurance must cover and raising costs for everyone, I don't think you don't need to do that. I genuinely believe that a freer market, not a completely free market, but a freer market would improve conditions for everyone, that there would be more jobs. People would have health insurance, more health insurance.
Jack, how do you see this actually playing out? We've got Kabuki, we've got threats, we've got a real potential. The reporters are saying of shutdown. How do you see this playing out, Jack, and what does it hinge on, the course this takes?
Well, you know, I think that, I mean, it looks like the Republicans are shooting Niagara. I mean, they really are playing.
What do you mean?
They could go over the falls.
Which means what?
Which means that they could shut down the government, that they could force a default. That is within their power. And a kind of, you know, extremism, or at least a great fear, has taken hold of the Tea Party people that Obamacare is going to introduce something fundamentally un-American and toxic into our system. And I hold accountable for that. I don't think that's true. I don't think that's an accurate statement. The refrain you hear is, it is a government takeover of health care. You know, PolitiFact called that the lie of the year in 2010. That simply isn't true. And the fault, I think, respectfully to John and to the Weekly Standard, is that the Republican intelligentsia hasn't represented the truth to their own party, that they have kind of gone along with it. And there was a rueful editorial in the Wall Street Journal this week that was saying, this is a kamikaze mission, hold back, and then wondering aloud, maybe we encourage this too much. Well, maybe they have. And now these seemingly hapless Tea Party people who have been foxed into this desperate move, partly by Ted Cruz, whom they loathe now. Look at the things they're saying about him on TV this
because
morning.
Because he sort of led people on and then backed away.
Yeah, and now they're
Jack, but they don't feel hapless. They feel like, look, this is the Alamo. We got to defend it. No, I don't mean that in a derisive way. I mean, you can hear the sincerity in many of these people of their opposition.
Oh, yes, indeed. I just meant hapless in the sense that they're furious at Cruz and the right for sort of, you know, daring them to do it. They did it, and now Cruz says, oh, well, you guys fight it out.
John, what about the divisions within the GOP on this?
It has a lot to do with the 2014 and 2016 Republican primaries. You're going to want to have people like Ted Cruz who can go out there and say, listen, I had a plan to stop Obamacare, and these guys, they just wouldn't go along with it because he knows it's going to happen. So he just wants to get to the right. There's sort of this arms race, and I think that Republicans are almost victims of their own success. Back in the day, you used to prove that you were a true fiscal conservative by opposing earmarks. Well, Republicans got rid of earmarks in 2011. You used to be able to show that you were a true fiscal conservative by even grabbing the third rail of entitlement reform. Well, every single Republican almost in the House and the Senate voted for Paul Ryan's Medicare reforming budget. So I think that you see this arms race to get to the right and show that you're the true conservative, and it's setting unrealistic expectations.
Katrina, we've got 10 seconds. Does Obamacare finally get through and this will be a crazy storm in our rearview mirror or not?
It does get through, and it'll become a part of the fabric of people's lives. And I think 5 years after the financial crash, a lot of people who care about the health of this country are going to need to build on that to make it Medicare for all.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, video mega game Grand Theft Auto 5 raked in over $800 million worldwide in its first day of sales Tuesday, the biggest first-day video game haul in history.
Job, my score, get your own.
You are alone, you pathetic psychopath.
Great. Heavyweight boxing great Ken Norton died Wednesday at 70. He had three memorable fights with Muhammad Ali and won their first bout, breaking Ali's jaw in a 12-round split decision, 1973.
Ali's mouth is bloody. The left gets in and a good right. He is all over Ali. He is punching him around the ring.
And on Sunday, Miss New York, Nina Davuluri, was named Miss America, the first Indian-American to take the crown. She faced a slew of racist remarks on social media, but responded with dignity.
Ladies and gentlemen, your new Miss America is Miss New York!
Of course, there's extreme people who are always going to say things, but you have to rise above that, and that's the platform that I have for this year to promote that diversity.
There's Miss America. We're looking at a week in the news, the Navy Yard massacre, Obamacare, and shut down new signals from Iran, the Pope, and there is Syria. John McCormick is with us from the Weekly Standard. Katrina Vandenhoevel is here, editor and publisher at The Nation magazine. Jack Beatty is here. John McCormick, Iran, what do you make of the new tone there? The newly elected, recently elected president making all kinds of friendly noises this week. He's going to be in the U.S. Next week, big meetings at the U.N. Do we have something important for the U.S. to pay attention to here, John?
I mean, there's a lot of talk, and I think that we ultimately need to see if there's any actions taken to follow up on this. I'm very skeptical that they're sincere, that they honestly want to discuss, sort of an opening, a dialogue where we can verify that they're not pursuing nuclear weapons. But I'll believe it when I see it.
Here's the Iranian president himself talking with extraordinary interview with NBC's Ann Curry. This was on Wednesday. He hooked Curry first, then the Iranian president, interpreted by NBC.
Can you say that Iran will not build a nuclear weapon under any circumstances whatsoever?
The answer to this question is quite obvious. We have time and again said that under no circumstances would we seek any weapons of mass destruction, including nuclear weapons, nor will we ever.
Katrina, is there something new to build on here? Of course, Iran's in the background of the Syria conflict as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the election of a new, more moderate president in Iran has set the stage for possible progress on nuclear negotiations. And, you know, the Iranian nuclear program isn't the only reason to test for a better relationship. As we've seen this with the Syria crisis, it becomes increasingly clear that diplomacy is the only way to achieve long-lasting political resolution to the security challenges the U.S. faces in the Middle East.
So, Jack, here we are. I mean, we go from on the verge of blasting away at Syria over chemical weapons use to now two tracks, maybe, of diplomacy here. Does it feel real or like we're in some funny bubble, Jack?
Both, I think. And it's a lucky thing for the president that he didn't fire missiles into Syria, because Iran experts were saying that could be a deal breaker with the Iranians. And the Iranian president sort of praised the president for not doing that. Well, really, he was praising the Congress and the people for rebelling against the president. But that's the kind of, I won't call it dumb luck, but at least unintended benefit that the president seems to be reaping here. He didn't fire into Syria. He hasn't. And that has helped him with Iran. But also with Iran, as in Syria, we do see that coercive diplomacy tends to work. I mean, you just can't argue it with Syria. The threat of the attack got action out of the Russians. Similarly, with Iran, not necessarily a threat of attack, although the president, you know, has set us on a course to war with Iran if they don't.
All
they
options don't
come
on
around.
The table.
Yes,
yep.
And deterrence is off the table. I mean, think of that. But the sanctions have just been so punishing to Iran that now even the supreme leader seems to be on board with a charm offensive thus far, but charm offensives can sometimes lead to real romance.
The president on Sunday was sort of taking that line that it was our coercive readiness that led to this new opening with Syria. Here he was on ABC News' Stephanopoulos show.
As a consequence of the pressure that we've applied over the last couple of weeks, we have Syria for the first time acknowledging that it has chemical weapons, agreeing to join the convention that prohibits the use of chemical weapons, and the Russians, their primary sponsor, saying that they will push Syria to get all of their chemical weapons out. The distance that we've traveled over these couple of weeks is remarkable.
John McCormick, very interesting distance indeed, and people celebrating on the right and left that we're not at a shooting war or engagement in Syria in many quarters. What do you think of where we are, though, John? Do you trust the commitments that are being made? Syria's already stepped forward in a lot of ways. We hear today that they've laid out where the chemical weapons are to international inspectors. Do you see this as for real or a kind of buying time, John?
I mean, we completely stumbled into this diplomacy, this negotiation. John Kerry made an offhand remark about how if the Syrians agreed to give their chemical weapons in a week, they could avoid everything. The Russians immediately jumped on that, so did the Syrians.
Well, and you make your own luck, right?
I mean, well, and Assad is now, in his Fox News interview, he said that, well, yeah, you know, it might take a year to get these chemical weapons under control. It might take, you know, I need $1 billion. So I think right now on the world stage, he's basically humiliating us. I don't support war. I didn't support military action. There are no good options. I understand that the president is a difficult situation. You don't want an Al-Qaeda state in Syria, and you don't want to help out a dictator who's murdering his own people with chemical weapons. But it's a bad situation.
How humiliating!
And I think,
you know, he's agreed to give up.
Assad's paid no consequences. He's paid no price.
But Tom, yeah? John, the idea that this was a gaffe, or that this emerged out of nowhere. You know, Walter Pincus had a column in the Washington Post the other day. U.S. and Russian technical experts were doing preparatory work for ending Syria's chemical weapons capability for months before the two nations' Geneva meetings.
Yep.
And the initiative on Syria's weapons capability had its roots in a June 2012 talk between President Obama and Russian President Putin.
Short talk.
I mean,
but
I think it's a very important. Mm-hmm. I think at this stage, what is so encouraging, again, is this kind of disconnect between much of the elite, which really did support military strikes, and an American public who wanted a more, who saw there was a false choice that it was either do nothing or military strikes. So I think we have the opening for a different foreign policy, a less imperial, more engaged, a true internationalist policy. And I think, as Reagan said of Mikhail Gorbachev, another Soviet Russian president many years ago, trust but verify. But here I would say test, 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 because in the end, if we can have Syria dismantle and destroy its chemical weapons, it is a far more effective message moving forward and a deterrent than simply 2 or 3 days of missile strikes, which might slightly degrade Assad's chemical weapons.
Katrina,
I think we're on a road to see diplomacy as the way forward and to revive, admittedly, an institution with problems, but the United Nations is an important international institution of legitimacy. And I think it would be wise for America to become a more central part of that and respect the limits of U.S. power in this world today.
Do you favor keeping the threat of a strike on the table through this period while the world watches what happens or does not happen in Syria?
You know, I favor that it's everyone knows it's there. Do I favor Secretary Kerry coming forward every other day to say it's there? And to, with all due respect for Secretary Kerry, who I believe has played a critical role with his counterpart, Foreign Minister Lavrov, blustering about it, I don't think that's helpful. I think you need to work with the deadlines. The deadlines need to be tested and, you know, and used effectively. But there needs to be a nimbleness, which I think President Obama showed. And it's sort of ironic and silly sometimes to see critics criticizing Obama for not doing this, doing this. I think he found a way to respect the people's will and also find a way out of what he, I think, understood, even though some of his closest advisors did want military strikes, was not going to be a winning bet for the United States.
Let me get a call from
national security.
Yeah, Decatur, Illinois. Jerome, you're on the air. Thanks for calling, Jerome.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think one of the issues that the American people are concerned about, and if our elected officials are representing us, I think that we have more of a distrust and a sort of a disconnect in terms of what these officials are saying and the evidence. And also the fact that if you even had 10 Al-Qaeda fighters over there, why should we be given any type of assistance militarily or anything?
So, Jerome, are you happy to see a military strike avoided?
Yes.
Why?
Because we don't really know what's going on. That's a sovereign country. Syria is a sovereign country. And how would we like it if someone said they're going to come over and throw Obama out of office or anything like that? They don't know what's going on in the United States.
Jerome, I appreciate your call. John McCormick, what do you make of the right-left kind of getting together on this, the president having trouble with his own party when it was the strike threat, and the same kind of impulse in the Tea Party sector of the Republican Party, John?
Well, it just didn't make sense. Lob a few missiles in the country to prove a point, to send a message. You need to have a clear objective. That's the first rule.
But you said Assad needed to pay a price, I think I heard you say a minute ago.
I said he hasn't paid a price. I'm just saying there were no good options, and I didn't support that because I wouldn't have raised the stakes and said that, blustering talking in terms of the Holocaust and then letting this guy get off scot-free. I think that it was a bad situation where if we could have aided the rebels, moderate forces, 2 years ago, that would have been ideal. And I don't know. I don't read the intelligence report. I don't have intelligence reports in front of me to tell me, are there enough moderate forces that they can beat an Al-Qaeda forces back should Assad fall? I don't know that. I think that I'd need that information before I can make an intelligent decision. So I just don't know what the best policy is there. But given where we are now, that the radicals are increasing their power, you definitely don't want to tip the balance of power to them. So I understand that it was a bad situation, but you don't go out there and announce exactly what you're going to do and you're going to bomb these sites so they can move around their weapons and then and talk in terms of the Holocaust and then say, oh, you know, well, we're going to let Vladimir Putin handle this.
Well, I wouldn't put it quite in those terms as a negotiation going on. I can see that argument. On the other hand, if the chemical weapons are now being disposed, listed and will be disposed of, that looks like some kind of win. Jack, there's a lot of talk about President Obama in trouble in his second term because even within his own party, he's got all this dissent. There was such dissent on going at Syria. There was such dissent on Larry Summers as the one-time Obama-backed prospective next head of the Federal Reserve Bank. On both of those, you know, he lost that support. He's without it. Major Garrett writes in National Journal, you know, he's in trouble. Second-term slump. Is that what it is, Jack, or something else?
Well, it is, and yet there does seem to be a kind of inchoate success here, right? I mean, it's inconceivable that Syria is going to use these chemical weapons now. I mean, just because of the, you know, so that looks like a success. And if, in fact, it leads to a, you know, this agreement works, lots of things can go wrong, an infinity of things. If it works, it'll be a triumph. Now we have Iran coming forward with a triumph. So we'll see about that. But the president seems to be having these successes, quote unquote, on the world stage. But here, no. I mean, his party, which, you know, was in lockstep with him, they are resisting him. And I thought the Larry Summers turnaround was really noteworthy. I mean, these were people on that banking committee. And effectively, the president wouldn't have been able to get that nomination out of that committee. It probably would have passed on the floor, but he wouldn't have been able to even get it out of the committee because of Democratic defections. And there, you have to say the people who did that, you know, people like John Tester and Jeff Montana, Merkley from Oregon, they kept going back and saying, this guy, Larry Summers, is the author or one of them of our disorder. You know, he's one of
the
architects of there has to be some accountability. We would have just the opposite if we put him into the Federal
Reserve. Nearly $1 billion kind of fine for JP Morgan in this week, so that's still unfolding. We've got people calling in on, of course, the Navy Yard shooting, and I don't want to avoid that at all. 12 dead, the shooter dead, the shotgun, the pistol taken off the security guard. And there we are again. Dana in Hyden, Kentucky. Dana, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yes, sir.
I think this is a good opportunity, actually, for them to find common ground. I think the issue myself is that we need to keep the guns out of the hands of crazy people, people that have mental problems.
Mm-hmm.
The common ground is what the problem is with the powers that be. They don't have they're both sides are very passionate. You know.
So what, background checks on issues of mental instability, Dana? Is that what you're pushing for?
I think they're going to have to do something like that. I think both sides can agree on that.
Yeah, let us pick it up right there. Our time is short. John McCormick, how about it? Do you see a consensus? Now, in this case, I'm not sure that this particular shooter ever had a medical encounter that would have put him on that list, but there's been all kinds of resistance to an effective national background check that would make that possible. What about now, John?
Well, he did call the police in Rhode Island and actually talked about how he's hearing voices. He was being chased by people, clearly exhibiting delusional behavior, that he was a troubled person. I do think
would
that,
you like to see that put on, you know, a box
like
check
see,
that would
would
take him out of gun ownership with that call?
I mean, I think we already have those laws. He
no, we
got
don't.
Passed it. I think that we should make. I think
we don't.
We should
calling
make it
the
easier.
Like that is not enough to get you off the list.
No, and it doesn't even get you help. I'm saying right. that people, we should make it easier to get people help to it's very difficult right now to commit someone, to get them help. And obviously there's problems there too. You don't want to be throwing people. People have liberty even if they have mental issues and yep. paranoia or schizophrenia.
Yep.
But some of these laws have gone too far the other way. And I do think that we need to – I don't know exactly what every person who yep. buys a gun should have I don't know how they would be this person never saw – I don't know exactly what yeah. kind of mental health check you'd want. But
well, there wasn't much for him, sure. Katrina. There has been certainly resistance to an effective national blanket, even on the mental health front.
I mean, you know, yes, focus on mental health, but to suggest that as a catch-all solution to gun violence is unrealistic. I mean, if you're saying focus on mental health, then you're saying that we want a way to keep guns away from people who are dangerous, and you can't do that without universal background checks. So we're back to... what seems to me common sense laws, which 90% of Americans support in terms of the background checks.
And 12 more dead. The drumbeat of those mass shootings, just too much in recent American history, and yet it goes on and on. We'll see where that takes us. Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation. Thank you so much for joining us today, Katrina.
Thank you.
John
thank
McCormick,
you.
Staff writer for The Weekly Standard. John, great to have you here. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, thank you. Have a good weekend, sir.
Thank you.
On Monday, we will talk about our new kind of Pope, Pope Francis, and all of his latest. Follow us at onpointradio.org. Follow me on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I am Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.